Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave. Right in 2021, please help me, God. Rupert with me is Chris in the neon booth today, Quare. Chris, you upgraded your booth and it looks
a little bit
fabulous.
Yeah, I did the thing where I was on Instagram and there was a beautiful photo of this like lamp in the corner that shot rainbows out of it. And I was a little faded at the time. I think it was New Year's Eve. And I was showing it to everybody. I was like, look, you know, we're drinking champagne. I'm like, should I buy that? You know? And they're like, sleep on it, dude. You know, just like put it, you know, like, think about it.
Chris Quare pushes that button. Chris Quare knows how to push that
button. I do push that button, but I did sleep on it. God bless myself. And then I still bought them because I think they're good. Cool. I tried them in the corner and I was like, you know what? I'm going to mount these damn things on the roof of my booth. The roof of the booth. Nice. And they look beautiful and they have cool modes. Like they literally shoot rainbows. So enjoy.
See, I think here in the pandemic, if you could spend whatever, $5, $10, $100, $200, $2,000 just to get a little piece of happiness, it's entirely worth it. Did the Ruperts move a couch to look at the Christmas tree and decide we need to buy a whole new couch? Yeah, we did.
That's great.
We now have two living rooms. Surprise.
Everybody's going to have kick-ass houses when this pandemic is over, you know?
Just, yeah. It's like, Dave, where'd you get this weird bronze horse sculpture? Oh, well, 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of invested internally. I don't know if you know what I mean there. That's cool.
Upgrades.
I saw a beautiful photo. I didn't even know it snowed in Austin ever, but apparently it did. You have more snow in your yard than I did in mine for a minute there.
2 inches of snow in Austin, Texas. I don't talk about the weather too much. It's pretty.
No, but it's about your shed, which is a beautiful thing. And it looked like it was out of a field in Japan. Just beautiful.
My shed's good. They're putting a roof on it as we speak, which means they can put stuff inside of it after there's a roof on there. So I think we're moving forward and it could be next week or for sure. I think next week I might be moving.
Do you run fiber out to it?
Fiber's going to get run out to it, or like they're going to run an Ethernet to it and then drop a line in the, you know, into my house. And I may just have them wire up my house while they're in here. Cause I don't know.
Yeah.
Might as well. So I don't know. I wish I was like had a master plan for whatever Ethernet in the house, but I really just need something out of there. But I could probably extend the Wi-Fi out there. Like maybe I'd get bad Wi-Fi at first, but,
I'd get Ethernet if you could.
No, it's all wired. There's like a jack on every wall. So that's good. So it's going to be good. Hopefully.
That's a downgrade from my booth. I have one in this office that I'm in. There's one place where the internet comes in and it's in an office on a wall. And it does. So the only way to get Ethernet to this booth would be to freaking dangle it across the floor or some crap, you know?
Yeah, you could tack it up through your roof maybe, but that's still.
You'll have to see the roof in here. It's 50 feet in the air. It's crazy.
Yeah. You know what I do? I bought on Amazon. Speaking of impulse purchases, I bought this. It's a reel. It's like a.
Like Van Halen rolls into town and is wiring up the thing and there's guys like running across the field with
with a big wheel of Ethernet. That's what I have. It's like 50 feet of Ethernet.
Nice.
And I could just like when my whole family goes to sleep, I can go plug in my Ethernet cord and get super fast games. But
That's great. And then you wheel it back up. That's great. The last time I saw one of those was this guy Brad I used to work with at the old office from Kraft. We were wiring up that office, which was just a sight to behold. That the old office, as much as, you know, I'm much more happier at the new office, had we wired the walls, you know, with Ethernet and had a big server rack that could just dish out the, because we had fiber over there too. So in this new building, no fiber and the Ethernet's a pain in the ass. I have it at my desk because I literally just draped it across the floor and bought that like carpet covering stuff to cover it.
It's fine.
But he always had the Ethernet. He was like the Ethernet guy. And not only did he have the spool, but he had the chops to be able to cut it and then add the Ethernet. So like he could
cramp and wire.
And in 2 seconds, he could make you an Ethernet cord of any length. And he knew he could. And he would just walk into people's offices and be like, you need an Ethernet cord? How long? 2 feet? 6 feet.
2 foot 4, 2 foot 5.
What do you need? I can do it. That is kind of a superpower to make Ethernet of any length.
No, that's, I mean, that's like, I have done this in my house in college. We stapled holes in the wall.
Yeah, you did.
Stapled on the outside, all like 10,000 feet of Ethernet cable. And I did it. And there's all these like weird rules too. Like you have to do what's called a cross wire. Like you flip two wires to like, if you're doing it in a jack or something. And
what? Anyway, I don't know about that.
But it was like a cross cable is what it's called. But yeah, like we ended up like wiring all this stuff. We destroyed that house. I'm surprised they let us do it. But
is there a point, Dave, where the Wi-Fi, because it evolves every time I look at a router, it's A, then B, then A B, then N plus, then N to the triple plus. All those are wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. Is there a point at which Wi-Fi technology isn't absolutely not the bottleneck anymore and that it's countable just as much as Ethernet is?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I think there's like, you know, I think a wire, you know, it's 8 wires, you know, a wire can get cut. That's like a huge liability, you know, but ideally you don't cut wires. But I think with Wi-Fi, the issue is like radio frequencies, and you get this with too, like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth sometimes like don't get along, you know, like they kind of fight over the same kind of available bandwidth, you know, cause it's like radios, it's microwaves. It's, you know, behind my current desk is a fireplace. We didn't know that when we bought the house. We discovered about a month into it, hey, we have a fireplace.
What? They just papered over it or whatever?
Yeah, it's just walled over, but I didn't know that was there. We may open it up again one day. Oh my
God, there's 100 rats in there, I'm sure.
Yeah, but good rats. I mean,
they probably have tea parties.
Yeah. But anyway, there's a big fire. I think like just the reflection of the beams or whatever, like going off this brick is not great, you know? And I had all these Wi-Fi problems in my old shed at my old house. And I ran an Ethernet. I ended up finding somebody who'd run an Ethernet cable out there. Nice. And that helped a lot. But like, I think like that, I think the part of the reason was I had hardy board on the outside of it. You know what hardy board is? It's like cement planks that look like siding.
Oh yeah. I think I've broken some of those by accident.
Yeah. You've chipped them and you're like, that's a bummer. That chipped a lot easier than I hoped. But. So if you think I was like, my shed was actually like a cement coffin. Oh, okay. Like that's why I had bad Wi-Fi. Like in an,
yeah, right.
I don't know. It's all kind of making sense now, but I was.
Yeah, you can't beat the wire, can you?
No, you just can't. I mean, and that's the same with peripherals and stuff like that. They are saying, though, like it used to be with video gaming, like you had to be wired to get, because you're talking like 300 millisecond response times, you know?
It's on our guest notes page for this podcast. Please.
Oh, really?
Ethernet yourself, please.
Oh, really? Logitech has this thing called Lightspeed, but it's basically those like 2.4 gigahertz little dongles that you plug in, you know, like that they used to do before there was Bluetooth and everything.
So it's not Wi-Fi. It's
not
dongle. Wi-Fi.
It's not Bluetooth. It's like this, you know, kind of different bandwidth. And
don't 2.4, hate it.
Yeah, no, it's actually, and it's fast enough. Like it's faster.
Yeah, I mean, I trust it for my mouse. Than Bluetooth. Why wouldn't I trust it for my Wi-Fi?
So there's, you know, there's, I don't know. I think Wi-Fi could very improve, but maybe it's not the 802.11 spec. It's maybe something totally different, you know, that's like focuses on
one less wire. You know, at this point I'm not down to, I could see if I was like rocking the minimal desk thing, which I think is very cool. Like that's a way to operate your life. You buy like an iMac or whatever. So there's no cord even from the monitor to a machine and, you know, Bluetooth mouse, Bluetooth keyboard. Call it a day. Use the, you know, there's nothing on your desk. It's like unsplash ready. You know, you buy one fern in the corner and you buy something from that, what's that, Grove Made or something? Put your mouse on a little piece of felt or something just to really lock it in. That's one way to go. I didn't go that way. I got 100 things on my desk. So I'm not anywhere near zero wires. So like if I take one wire away because of the Ethernet, it's like not a material improvement. But I could see if you were down to like two or three, that the desire for zero is very high.
Yeah. No, I have a rat's nest. I bought a $300 dock for my Mac just to make it all
work. Did you rock the Cal Digit or what'd you go?
The Elgato.
Elgato. Trust Elgato. Got a package in the mail from them the other day.
Elgato is a brand I trust. But
hell yeah, it is. They make good stuff.
Yeah, but it's, you know, one wire into the Mac, and that's what I was looking for. Because I was like, you know, plugging in the speaker, the USB, the other USB, and I was just like, you know what? How much does it cost to get out of this? So,
wow, they're making a mic now. I just popped to their site to just to see, because I have, once they are a good brand, right? So all of a sudden, I got their key light,
Key light.
Yeah. And then I forget what else I have from them, but I was, my coworker Shaw, he's got a green screen because he does the keyframers, great little show on doing that. And they do the talking heads in the bottom left and bottom right on YouTube,
cool.
Green screen, got to do it. We're all starting to do video at CodePen,
I saw you're pivoting your CodePen.
Which is arbitrary. Like randomly, there'll just be a video instead of an audio one week, So we're sorting out the tech for it, in part because it's kind of fun. They make a green screen, Elgato does, and it's like, why not buy from a great company like that? So I mount it on my ceiling. I haven't actually done it yet. It's sitting over here.
Oh, and you get like a push button.
I wish. Maybe I'll wire something up. I have been into home electronics a little bit in that way.
I don't know. I could consider that. I think about streaming, and then I think, my situation is always like code streaming specifically.
I could watch your stream for sure.
Well, I'm like, okay, do I just like open up my client's website? Probably not. They probably wouldn't appreciate whatever Fortune 500 company, me just operating on it in the open. Right. They're not
probably not
into that. It turns out they're not into that. So I'm like, what could I do? Maybe I could make a video game like in stream or something, like just carve out an hour a day or something. I don't know, but it would have to be like something. So I'd have to figure that out.
Yeah. Can you do it with consistency, or does it even matter anymore? Because life is so chopped up. Can't you just if you're vibing it, just do it?
There's some cool people who stream when they vibe, but I think if you want to be successful,
you stream on Thursdays at 2. Yeah.
Thursdays at 2, Mondays at 2, this is way off topic for Shop Talk, but I saw this thing over the break about like Instagram. Somebody like basically leaked Instagram's algorithm. Did you see that? And they're like, they're asking us to do like 3 reels a week.
Oh, you know, a post every day. Yeah.
Something. And they're like, that's how you stay.
You got to use all their products.
You got to use all their products. You got to go in and like N number of photos. You can't just be a broad. You have to be like community member to get boosted in the algorithm.
Okay.
And like,
to some degree that makes sense. Or were you like, ooh,
I think it's cool, but there has to be some algorithm, right? Like, unless you want to just do chronological, which I would actually support, but I think the issue is you turn these people, wanted to be a content creator. Now I got to like abide in somebody else's rules or else I get $0. It's like, some dollars or $0, and so it's like I gotta like be a content labor camp just to like
kind of
show up in the Instagram
algorithm. I made an Instagram for CSS Tricks like I don't know a year ago maybe, and I don't really consistently do anything, but it's kind of fun and I poke at it once in a while. And I found through setup they have I don't know how the heck this works, but they have a app where I can upload video to my Instagram account from my Mac, which is nice, because otherwise it's a pain in the butt. What do you produce it, then put it in the cloud somewhere that your phone has access to and post it from your phone? You're like, no thanks. So once in a while, I'll be inspired. I'll be like, oh, this is a good little 10 seconds. I'm going to show this off. That's a video, not a, like pictures are easy. You just post the picture, but a little video is a different ball game. You produce the little video and then you blast it up to Instagram. Fine. And I'm like, people should watch that. That was cool. That's a cool 10. That's the point of this little Instagram, is little educational tidbits generally about CSS, But and then I read this post and I'm like, I will get zero. Nobody's going to see this thing because it's not also a reel and also a story. And also I didn't like 10 things today. And also, because I'm not playing the game, I'm just producing a little content, I get nothing.
Yeah. That's what, you know, I worry about some of these things, you know,
and the irony, I made a joke about it. It's all short form video. I story. It's a little piece of video. You post it. What's a reel? It's short form video. What do you, what can you just do a post? Yeah. It's short form video. What's a IGTV? Well, they call it long form video, but it's short form video.
Yeah.
All these different things are just little different ways to watch video. So I'm like, why is there so many different ones?
Yeah, no. You know, I think Twitch has hoops too. You got to jump through, you know, I know like YouTube, you got to do that, but you got to like get them likes. You got to get those subs, smash that like button, ring the bell, you know, and, mm-hmm. And I, as cool as that is, it's like, man, you got to play a game, you know, and maybe that's old man energy talking here. Like, I ain't going to play no games. I'm about to retire, but I just don't have the energy, you know, to like, right. kind of like micromanage my engagement just to hit a
algorithm threshold.
Algorithm. Yeah. So
doesn't part of you say, I mean, part of it's old, but part of it is like, and this can be taken away from me at any point ever. And the rules of the game can change at any point ever. That's, I mean, that's true of anything to some degree. But if you make content and you publish it at your site at a URL, old man waves at cloud, that will serve you for a long time. And the rules are less apt to change on you overnight, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's something to be said. The, is it Posse? Publish own site, syndicate elsewhere. You know, you put it on your site, you put your story on your site, it's there forever, you know, and it doesn't just disappear. But maybe you want stuff that disappears.
Posse is a good point, because then you do, to some degree, still get to be on that other platform and potentially gain some of the value of them. You're not quite playing the game as their rules are, but at least it's over there. And it could be over there in five places, you know?
Yeah. But it does seem like it's, you know, there is something to be said. Like, I mean, if you want to be popular, you start up a TikTok, tell some goofs, sing some sea shanties, and there you go. You're on your way to success.
So. It just seems so, you know, seems so wispy. If you do it that way, I don't have as high of peaks, you know, like if I rock some sea, maybe you'll have your day in the sun, but I feel like, do you want a 10-year career in that? I mean, if you do, then you may need a different approach. And if you don't, that's cool too. You know, well, who cares?
Man? I want to be in a sea shanty. I want to be popular. I want to be here for 15 minutes of the day.
I like the Colin Malloy tweet where he's like, sea shanties were so 2003.
Oh, dang.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Equinix Metal. They didn't say to say metal like that, but you kind of have to, I feel like, because it's pretty metal anyway as a product. So Equinix is the world's digital infrastructure company. They have this brand new product, Equinix Metal. Fully automated, bare metal as a service gives you the freedom to build any way you want, anywhere you want it. So this is digital infrastructure, as they say. These are, you're buying servers here to run your stuff, you know? So this is something you reach for when you know you need some infrastructure to power the thing that you're building. And you want something that's like good and that like has developers in mind for real. So they're kind of like a bunch of developers over there where like, you know, I see what's happening in digital infrastructure. We're going to like start over and do it better and do it ourselves. And that's what happens here. It's like a for developers by developers infrastructure product. For one thing, it's info.equinix.com /shoptalk. That just go there and just put your name and they give you $100 to try it anyway. So if you just want to play around, you know, you have some incentive to do that. So thanks to them for that. $100, info.equinixmetal.com/shoptalk. And it'll be in the show notes, of course, to just add metal, they say, which is awesome. This isn't necessarily for like, I need a server for my personal blog or whatever. I mean, like you could probably do that if you want the world's most metal badass personal blog, but it's like you're buying real servers to do big work, you know, and we're talking global data centers here. You know, they have 220 little physical data centers around the world. Pretty awesome. So this is serious digital infrastructure for your products. Check them out. Thanks for the support. Oh.
last week we asked about convoluted processes, and we got a taker. Jim Nielsen writes in with his Netlify public folder part one. That's a good tip that it's going to be just a beast of a process. Mm-hmm. It's a three part thing. Anyway, recreating the Dropbox public folder with Netlify. So mm-hmm. Jim does some interesting tricks with Netlify. He has a little like tool that will notify him in his, like send a growl message if his build completes, like on his machine. But,
so what's anyway. The idea? It's for your local computer in the Dropbox public folder. Remember, RIP doesn't exist anymore, but the idea is whatever mm-hmm. you put in there is kind of publicly available through some UI, which was, I thought, agree was nice. That's not gone anymore. It doesn't mean that you can't share stuff publicly on Dropbox. You totally can. It's just a little bit more explicit, you know?
Yeah. And so like Dropbox public folder was like, hey, I will drop a file in here and then I get a public URL and then I can whatever self-host my own Giphy if I want, you know, my own mm-hmm, bucket. Mm-hmm. And he figured out how to do that with Netlify, but Netlify has like upload a folder thing, but it's like you have to upload the same folder every time. You can't just add a file to this virtual cloud folder.
Oh, really? Can't you just put it in Git and Git will deal with that part?
Well, I think that's what kind of the background thing that's happening here is like a whole kind of Git kind of flow here.
So the idea is put a file in a folder and wipe your hands. And some magical code runs such that that file eventually will have a public URL that's kind of guessable or whatever. I don't know if there's any UI involved here, but yeah, this does seem cool. And I see where the convolution part comes in here is that, okay, well, you got to like write a little Node script and then how are you going to run the Node script? You need a little file watcher and then how are you going to notify yourself that it's done and whatever. There's like a lot of moving parts to this thing. So
I love
convolution.
It.
I can see one of the tools involved is called Bitbar. That's kind of interesting. It looks like it's a Mac thing that allows you to spin up a little menu bar app real quick and then put whatever you want inside the menu bar app. That's kind of
appealing. Yeah, you can like write whatever script you want inside of there. That's the one he uses for his like Netlify notifications workflow, but you can do. It's a good post because like I've actually found that out, like, I don't know, have like three or four projects on Netlify like this week, you know, and it's fine, but I don't know when people are building and committing on different branches or whatever. I may see it I kind of only care if it's successful or if it fails. And so I'm kind of like, man, maybe I need to like write this up myself. So,
maybe give it a shot. Out. You know, speaking of menu bar apps, I think somebody suggested this to me the other day because I had a menu bar app idea. I'll share it here in case somebody wants to build it. Well, have you ever like gone to the command line and typed like, hey, npm run dev or whatever? And then it's like, oh, but port 3001 is busy right now. You can't run it on port 3001 or 9000 or 8000 or whatever it is. So you're like, why? What is running there? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then if you Google it, it'll be like, just do ps aux dash x pipe.
Kill all.
Yeah. And then you'll get the PID. Yeah. And then, you know, you're like, okay, but why can't I just see where it's running and turn it off? Like, I don't know. I just wish that was a little easier. And sometimes I don't even have iTerm open. There are no terminal windows running. So what the F? Anyway, this app, you know, these apps that are designed for responsive design where you can have the same URL open in like five devices at once, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Like,
Polypane is one.
Yeah.
Sizzy is another one.
Sizzy. Yeah, that's one.
Yeah, there's some free ones too, whatever. But Sizzy happens to be the one that I just noticed this little feature on. And I was like, that's a nice little developer bonus thing. There's a little X icon in the header. You open up the X and you just type in the port number and click a button and it just finds whatever's running on that port and kills it. And I was like, that's nice. That's what I want. But I don't really want to open Sizzy. I find Sizzy a little heavy, actually, to open. It takes a minute. So I was like, but I still do it because I like that convenience. So I was like, what if there's a little menu bar app that would just do that one little thing? I didn't have to actually open Sizzy. And somebody's like, just use Bitbar or whatever. There's other little GitHub repos that are designed to be like, you don't actually have to learn Swift, you know?
Yeah.
You just spin up the thing and it'll run a little Node script or whatever for you.
Yeah, because it can run Bash and then you can just call Node from Bash some...
Yeah, huh. Or you could write it in Bash. I don't know, but I wouldn't know. I'm like,
this
Node
is the
only.
Stuff I'm excited to be back on Mac for, to be honest. Yeah. Is these just like oh, there is Unix there and probably Node. You know, like Windows was kind of like, I don't know what you got. So, how about .NET framework? But no, that's kind of interesting. I don't know.
Well, thanks, Jim, for sending in your flow. I would agree that it qualifies as convoluted. If anybody else has a convoluted thing like they did at work or something, there's some great stories. Remember that one about the email that would only travel a certain number of physical miles? That was like one of the great tech stories of all time, I think.
Oh,
no, I'll send you that one.
Oh, no, I don't remember this, but it's an email that only goes 10 miles.
Yeah, like they somehow figured out that like you could email, you know, Arizona from LA, but not New York or something like that. It would consistently fail and they had to track it down. And the reason was so incredibly convoluted, but did really actually manifest as physical miles.
Man, how could you? I mean, you explaining that to your boss, like, okay, you know, email, right? Yeah. It's everywhere. You can email China.
Yeah.
We cannot email Arizona.
Yeah. I mean, it took 10,000 words to explain even how they figured out the problem, but it was real. I'm sorry. This is bad podcasting. I should tell you what the solution is, but I literally don't remember. Sorry.
I don't know. I'm sure it's install some server somewhere to fix it. I don't know. But anyway, hey, Chris, we only did one question last week. You want to hop into some questions this week?
I'd be happy to. Sean Gore writes in about, I think, about Dividus, essentially. Remember that? Remember that term?
I love
Too many dims.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, Chris, thank you so much for your podcast. Love everything you guys have been doing, following you guys forever. As a longtime web developer with decades of experience, it just seems like HTML and proper markup have increasingly less importance in modern web development processes. I find increasingly that libraries like React promote Dividus, spewing divs all over the place, and having to teach it in Canada just kind of sucks for me. And it seems like they just have no regard for using proper HTML elements like article, details, dialogue. And I know that probably doesn't apply to everybody in the community, but it just bothers me a lot to see that HTML just kind of get thrown to the back seat. And furthermore, with the advent of web components, it seems as though browser vendors have stagnated in their implementation of new HTML elements. For example, we don't see much progress happening on the dialogue element, and the detail summary whole thing just makes it really difficult to use for accessibility. So with that being said, it just seems like all the burden has been offloaded to third-party JavaScript libraries. So my question to you guys, how can we promote and reinvigorate the initiatives proposed for new HTML custom elements and enforce those to get shipped with browser vendors as opposed to trying to have all these different ways of creating common functionalities? For example, like why don't we have an accordion element yet?
There's a lot. First of all, Dave, do JavaScript client-side libraries promote Dividus or not? Is that their fault? If that is even a problem, and do they promote it if it is a problem?
I think it could, and I will say I've even seen people say like, you only need to know div and span and you can figure out the rest later, you know, mm-hmm, and that's mm-hmm. like a big, oh no, you know?
Right.
But to be fair,
there's I'm there a block too. I'm element like kinda,
and an inline element, you know, like there are semantics and it would be good to know what they do. I think especially in inputs, I think like if we all understood inputs a lot better and labels, life would be a lot better for a lot of people.
But I
think too, when everything's a component and you need to like style around stuff, you know, a lot of people just will be like, you know, and one thing that React kind of did, I think the limitation is going away, I believe, in both of those. But you would have to, in order to render JSX, you'd have to open it with the div tag. And like, it has to be wrapped. It has to be one,
yeah,
element, right?
Right. And that's usually a div because it's just
usually a div. And now you can do like a ghost element thing.
Right.
But I think that limitation is starting to fade away. Mm-hmm. I don't know what versions or whatever.
React, you still need a fragment, I think, but it allows you to do that. And then, but then, you know, so then, yes, it was promoting divitis because you needed the div. And even with the fragment, I mean, how many people are actually using fragments? I mean, I'm sure I do here and there, but I also kind of think that, like, kind of who cares? Like, a div is meaningless. So by using a div, you are in no way harming accessibility. I mean, maybe there's a few extra tiny bytes of HTML that are getting shipped that don't need to be. But in the grand scheme of things, a div is not a big deal. Using a div incorrectly is a big deal. But just having a div isn't some big problem.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I definitely used extra divs for styling, you know, like, you know, if I had this, I could, like, you know, that could be a container or something, you know, or whatever. But I think it's, I think there's a little bit of a contribution there and a little bit of contribution. You know, I think in the last 5-10 years, we've had a huge influx of people, you know, post web standards movement come into the industry, and maybe some of that kind of sort of knowledge transfer was lost, you know,
I totally agree.
Elements and, right, and everything does. So, I mean, it's, this is great because more people are getting more money. So hooray on that. And it's like a broader field, but also we need to make sure everybody's up to snuff on what all the features of HTML are.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of a problem when somebody's like, oh my God, a details element, you can click it and open and reveal something underneath of it. Oh my God, I'm about to delete 7,000 lines of code or something. At that point, you're like, okay, there was a little communication breakdown here. You know, yeah, like that was a little weird.
The marketing department fell asleep.
But then Sean at the same time is like, why isn't everybody using dialogue? Well, that's a communication breakdown too, because the status at the moment is don't use it. It's bad. So it's, like, it's careful there.
Accessibly, you know? Feature complete.
Yeah, you know, right. It causes more problems than it helps.
Yeah. And then web components did come out and people are just like, make your own elements. You know, and I would put React components and Vue components and everything in the same bucket. It's like, you know what? Just write your own thing. Mm-hmm. You know, don't, the HTML is not coming. Write your own thing. And web components is just kind of a distribution channel for pre-built components. It is creating more JavaScript, and I don't like that. I would rather have some HTML primitives like tabs, accordion, you know, pop over or whatever. And, you know, if you want to get involved with that, there's a wonderful site called openui.org. You can start getting involved there and on GitHub.
I do kind of forget that. Is the idea, though, that if you really knock it out of the park, that the end game is a native browser element?
Yeah, I have a post on this, and I'm actually going today. I'm going to a meeting, OpenUI meeting. So the idea at a high level is they're going through all the design systems and they're like looking at what everything's called, you know, and they're like, okay, accordions, what are common features in accordions? Like, and they basically build a blueprint of the thing. It's not a spec, but from a blueprint.
We did a whole show on this, remember? Right?
Yeah. You could maybe write a spec. And with the, if you have a spec, then you can maybe write a component, like a web component or something, or a browser could take that spec and adopt it. Not every component's like a badge component or something that's not going to go into HTML, you know, you know, but something like tabs or whatever might. And that's kind of what I've been working on, is working on a tabs element with quite a few people. So Jonathan Neal, Brian Cardell, Leonie Watson.
Yeah, that's a hell Pascal. Of a good team. So is the worst case scenario then, though, is that there's a very good tabs component that's a web component that will be usable kind of forever. Would we get it in HTML, but if we don't.
Yeah, and I think the idea here too is like we have a spec of what it probably should look like from an accessibility standpoint and whatever. We have a spec, and then with the spec, we can kind of, you know, go talk to component authors, whoever, and just say, hey, I know you write this component. Let's just make it match the spec. Because if we can all match the spec, it doesn't matter what you're using. But maybe one day we can get an actual thing in the browser. So
yeah,
just to make sure we're not letting anyone down or whatever. So That's anyway, cool. That's you cool. could maybe write tests based on the spec too. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. like those tests should maybe be, you know, universal or something like that. So
is there a story? I think there kind of is, but maybe it's complicated. If this web component natively ships and it does everything, could somebody who has written a popular tabs in React one choose to kind of scrap their React specific implementation and it's still make a React component for tabs, but have it use the web component under the hood?
Yeah, in theory. And, you know, web components in React have kind of a big story there. But in theory, yeah, you could just, this could all be recycled or upcycled into the same mm-hmm. thing.
But then it's like the assumption then is Shadow DOM. And I could see somebody in React being like, no, I'm not going to put one thing in my app in the Shadow DOM. Like, that's right. not cool.
No, and in that case, it's fine. Go build your own thing.
Yeah.
But here's the thing that exists. Like, you can build your own H1 with div aria, yeah. like, or role equals heading aria level equals one. Like, you can build your own H1. It's just, should you? Probably not. Like, don't, you know? But I think there's potential, but I think the web components is kind of an important step. And this is like what I'm, my event apart talk this year is about is like, if we have a web component, there's maybe even a pathway where that web component goes into the browser. And that was like a couple of years ago, Chrome kind of said like, hey, we're building a toggle element called standard switch and standard toast. And they were just web components built into the machine. Like, kind of native web components. So you'd say like import a standard switch and it'd be like, cool, I know I'll just get it from my local host or my local browser. Yeah,
like native and modules like, that's been experimented with already. Remember the key value storage? That was one of them that was an experiment. It's been scrapped, unfortunately.
But. Yeah. But, you know, I think that like, I don't think that was a bad thing. I think it was a sudden thing for people. People are just like, what's a toast? Why is it you're shipping this in the browser? You know, mm-hmm. but I think there's a pathway. If we all can kind of come around like a really good web component or a really good template, like we could ship that in the component and then we could ship that out
to
a browser.
I think that developer usage story needs to be clarified a little bit and it's getting there. I think ESM is part of the story. I know I have millions of billions of thoughts on that, but if you could just go import boop, and it works. I mean, I know you're talking about pulling it right out of like browser storage or something. That's one thing, but it could be from NPM or wherever.
Import tabs from Skypack.
Yeah. Or whatever. From GitHub, from like, a CDN, whatever. So, and then you just use it. So the amount of lines of code that you're talking here for a developer who doesn't care about the innards of it, really, they just want to use good mm-hmm. tabs, is very mm-hmm. few lines of code. It's a pretty darn good developer story.
No, and then if you want to bundle it later, that's fine, you go bundle, do your thing,
right.
But like, we're just trying to get to a good tabs that everyone can use.
Yeah, import them, you know? Use them as a custom element. I think that story is pretty cool. It reminds me of Houdini. You know, Yuna made that Houdini dot how or now, I forget, I think it's how.
Yeah.
And some of them are, they show you a lot of code and it can look intimidating, but it's kind of to show you all the possibility. The real base story of Houdini can be really small. And Houdini, again, being this thing that can kind of like augment CSS possibilities, which is pretty mind-blowing. But for example, like have a behind the scenes things that's basically using a Canvas API to paint something on the screen, but you don't ever mm-hmm. see it. You write no Canvas code. Some author has written some stuff behind the scenes. All you do is import it, you know, ESM style. And then all of a sudden it's available to you. And the way that you call it is with this like, you know, paint parentheses thing in CSS that's specific to Houdini. And it can be like in like three lines of code, you can have like rainbow sparkle backgrounds. You know, the developer story behind Houdini or the usage story is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, in three lines of code, I have unicorn shit. That's cool. You know?
Well, and it's cool. Like you can like control with variables. It's like, I want angled corners, but I don't want the one. I want to like, so you're writing CSS variables to like control the behind the scenes canvas painting that the browser
right.
kind of stitches together, composites. Like, that's pretty dang cool.
That's become the story just because of the nature of those, of CSS custom properties and their like penetrative nature, you know, like they have access to that. So why not use that as the API for them essentially? And I love it. Mm. Perfect use case, I think. But that's true of lots of stuff. Is you can style SVG with custom properties that penetrate down into the SVG. You can web components. One of the big stories of styling web components is just use custom properties because they smash their way in there and then you can use them, you know?
No, I think there's going to be a cool future of people like making these Houdini things. And it's just like, oh, you know what? I'm looking at one from Zen Yang. It's called Houdini Leaf. It's just a bunch of leaves. You know what? I want leaves going up and down the side of my page. And I don't want some repeating GIF or whatever. I want it to be kind of fun and procedural, you know?
Like, right.
Cool. This is it. I want control over style. This is it. They made it. Like, it's done. Let's go.
Right. And it's probably, you know, like 1K or something. They tend not to be particularly large, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's just, I think you could like, it's like drop in styles and feelings into a page
drop in feelings,
you know.
Let's call it Houdini drop in feelings. I love it. Oh yeah, the tree is cool. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Netlify. High five, Netlify. Thanks for the sponsorship. They have a new product called Edge Handlers that's in early access that I think is extraordinarily cool. You know about Jamstack, right? Like static hosting and services on top of that. You can definitely think of an edge handler as a service on top of static hosting. But in a sense, it almost like changes the nature of Jamstack in a way, because you can, like, in a sense, intercept a request, manipulate it before it gets returned to a browser. It's like being able to run code at the CDN level, the edge, as they say. So imagine you're like have a particular route on your website. You can say, at that particular route, I want this edge handler to kick in, and I want this code to be run, and I want the response to be manipulated before it goes out. And all this happens just ridiculously fast at the edge, really geographically close to people, which is really cool. You could, for example, stop for a second, go hit a database, get some data, put that in the response and return it, or do some auth, or do some, there's all kinds of stuff that you can do. But imagine now you're still at the CDN level, but it's not just static assets. You have the opportunity to do dynamic things, but at the edge. Extremely powerful stuff. I think this is going to be a defining thing for the web coming forward. Doing this type of work at the edge is a big deal. It's worth wrapping your head around. It's worth requesting access to Netlify to play with this technology. Please do enjoy. And again, high five Netlify for the support. All right. So there's that. We're talking about dev experience in a way. Love that. Here, this is a very random one from Scott Krause, and I put it in here because I just love how direct it is. Hi, Dave. You should talk about the JavaScript debounce pattern on the podcast. So, Dave, what does debounce even mean? And doesn't it have like a brethren that's very similar but different?
Debounce and throttle are the two things. And I would more or less use them interchangeably. But the idea is if you're, let's say you do a scroll, like window on scroll, fire some event, whatever, change the text, like rotate the hue, rotate 1 degree or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to change the color of the text 1 degree on every scroll. Don't do this in production. That would be so horrible. But now I kind of want to see it. Yeah. I might make a code pen after this show. Anyway, so you have this text, right? And you're going to, or change the background. That's probably a more natural thing that people do. So when you do on scroll, that literally fires on every, or tries to fire on every tick it can. Every time the browser's like, I am scrolling, dude.
It's going to be fast. It's going to, maybe you scroll down once, it might fire 100 times.
Yeah, it might fire 100 times. This is really cool for your effect because it's going to be really smooth and amazing. But what's not cool is it will turn the fans on in the computer. Like it just, it works so hard. You're measuring like every, like, you know, whatever, 1 millisecond or something like that. You're trying to like ask the browser for information and change the whole page on every millisecond.
Sometimes it's your fault too, right? Because by firing it, probably might turn your fans on, but more likely it's the code that you're asking it to run when it fires.
Yeah, it has to run too much code in the time frame, and so you end up with this like stack of like calls where the event has fired 17,000 times, but you're like your first function hasn't even finished, and so you end up, that's where the CPU gets bottlenecked, and that's where you get like scroll jank and stuff like that. You know, if you like ever resized like Google Calendar, you probably know this feeling. You're just like, is it going to die? Is it going to die on me? And sometimes browsers do die because they're trying to do too much math and like explode. And so throttling and debouncing basically you basically set a set timeout somewhere in there and you say like scroll, but wait 100 milliseconds before you check if we've scrolled again or something like that. So it's basically like you can like basically set a timer on how often you're going to measure. If you're doing this on scroll, you're actually, I mean, you can do a debounce on scroll and you probably should, but it's probably not actually going to look like the effect you're looking for. But something on resize, people don't resize the page that often. So maybe you could get away with like a slower, you know, on resize, only measure this every 100 milliseconds or only do this every 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like how tall is the browser window right now? Imagine we didn't have viewport units to tell us that at CSS. In the past, we did not. You had to measure the height of the browser window and you're like, oh, I want this element to be that tall. So you could write code that says on resize of the window, calculate the height of the window and then talk to the DOM and say that element should be that high. Well, if you if you wrote that code and then resize the window a bunch, it's going to go because it's being fired a zillion times. That's why you debounce it. You'd say, please don't try to do that every time you get the DOM event. Do it every 1 second. So if you get 100 of these, do it once or do it twice. Slow down. And they're different. And I think debounce means that if you just resized your browser window and you just sat there doing it just over and over, and you never stopped, it would continue to still do it. It would go, it would do it according to your debouncing rules. Whereas I think throttling would be like, I'm going to wait till you're done and then I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Whenever you're done, then I will make this 100% tall. So,
right.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's libraries and stuff out there. I'm sure it's even on MDN or something like that if you need code for that. But it's a pretty good like performance trick if you're having the on scroll, everything looks like a robot is like barfing or just not doing well. Like,
isn't the concept really speed? Like DOM events are a great use case for this, but it's not anything. I mean, conceptually, it's just like anything that happens too quickly, you can slow down with debouncing and throttling.
Yeah. Yeah. If you know, request animation frame is like request animation frame would be something I'd probably try first, you know, it, like, you know, like do this, but only when you have a frame ready to draw. Like, I don't want you to like, you know, try to sneak this in, but you know, sometimes it's a scroll effect or sometimes it's a resize thing. Mm-hmm. You can think of like, if you're doing some kind of, watched box or whatever, like a resize sort of what do we call them, element queries, container query kind of thing where you change the whole element on resize. Like, you could do that on resize. One thing I would also consider is you can like just do a resize observer. That might be another thing.
Oh, and
I
think for resize events, observer, that's the way to go.
Because then you're just like, you know, this thing will detect a resize and then say, hey, I have resized. And that happens kind of on its schedule, not on
observers are sweet.
Not on the browser's schedule, you know, or like not on the real time resizing.
Right. And at this point, everybody knows what you're using observers for and that this debouncing throttling thing is like a big deal. So I'm sure that they would, that would be built into the API. Should we get a scroll observer? That'd be cool and neat.
Yeah.
I would think of like an open WebSocket too. Like, let's say you just have an open WebSocket and you're just waiting for stuff to come at you. And let it say it's a chat room and 1,000 people come into the chat room and start chatting. And it's just crazy the events that you're getting. You could be like, deal with that every second, or like wait till you get 10 messages and then do it. Or, you know, there's all kinds of patterns. No,
that'd be an awesome way to like throttle chats. I would pay money to do that, to be honest, because I'm in Twitch chats occasionally, you know, and I'm just like, what is going on? Can these, like, do teenagers have like super brains that they can like understand this like real-time stream of nonsense and pogger emojis and stuff like that? I have no idea what's happening, but
that's
children,
funny.
Man.
It makes me think of like, what do you think the call stack is in JavaScript? How many events can you stack up before you, before it's deadzo?
Before you, oh, that's a good question.
Because could you go to a website that has really slow debouncing? So you could ask the whole internet, hey, go to this page and type, and we'll infinitely stack your debounce in one, we'll put one character every second onto this page. And then there's like 2 billion key presses in the stack, and you could watch the entire world type infinitely. That would be
That's bad. A good way. I bet you could do it in a Google Doc. You could find out how quickly a browser can fall over. Just put 32 people in there and just be like 3, 2, 1 type, you know, like,
I wonder if it's millions. Do you think it's millions?
What's the limitation? Billions? I don't know. I bet the call stack's millions, but I bet the like theoretical how many people can actually happen. I bet it's, I don't know.
And does the browser protect it? Like, Chrome doesn't want to crash. Firefox doesn't want to crash on you. So maybe
they would just kill the tab.
Yeah.
They would, yeah, sad tab it.
Sad tab.
Is it that what it?
That's a new word.
Burp, burp, burp. So hopefully that helps, Scott. Thanks for the suggestion. Probably didn't do it justice, but hey. Steve Polito writes in, am I the only one that has a hard time making a good commit? I can't say it. So, Steve, you're not the only one. Am I the only one that has a hard time making a good git commit message? That is a tongue twister. I get in the habit of committing early and often, but this means I end up writing the same vague commit message over and over again. I know the solution to the problem is to be more verbose. It's a difficult habit to break. Any advice?
I have an active long-term project where somebody added some kind of Husky pre-commit hook thing that forces it. I don't even know if it's Husky. It's something. It's a pre-commit hook that is like, it yells at you if your commit message doesn't fit its concept of what a good commit message is. Have you ever had a project like that?
I haven't, but I've looked at this tool. I forget the name of it. It's like Git.
One of the rules is that it has to be prefixed in some way. It has to be chore colon space, which is like upgrading a dependency or whatever, or it has to be like feature or design, or I forget what the like okayed list is. But if your commit message doesn't start with one of those okayed words colon space, it just rejects your commit. It's like, nope, not good enough. So at least it's a little bit of like hand slap for like, do a good job with your commit messages. So far I've just been like angry at it only. Like, doesn't, yeah. I don't like it, but it's, you know, if the whole team had it, you know, if I got used to it, it'd probably be fine. But day one, you know, I was like, no.
Yeah. You know, I was in the, like, whatever, I got a new computer, I'm starting a new project. And I just was like, you know, what are the best, like, is there like a how to do Git like compendium? And I think I asked on Twitter and got some responses. I can share the link to that. But, That tool came up, like, you know, here's how you do a commit message, or you can enforce how to do a commit message. I like that. I try to stick to the like verb, like add, or like the present tense verb, fix, add, undo, but you know, like these action verbs, like verb, foo, on bar, like on the subject. So like, I did this on this? And I try to figure out that, and then I relate it to the issue. And then you can, like, I think best practice would be work in a branch and squash commit and stuff like that.
Controversial.
Well, it is, but I'm also just like, you know, hopefully it's micro enough that it works, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, if all your PRs are micro anywhere. I almost don't even care about commits. I want the PR to be clean. I want you. Yeah. I want the PR to be named well. I want there to be information in the PR about what you did. And I don't want there to be a bunch of dumb white space changes and shit like that. I want it to be clean looking PR, because chances are that's where I'm going to look at your code. And then I'm going to not look at a commit. I'm going to look at all the commits together as one big thing.
Well, and that's a great, like, maybe your commit messages don't matter, but it might help you, like, figure out, what did I do here? What was I trying to do?
Yeah, I'm not saying don't have good commit messages, but relative importance.
If you have a good PR, and then you squash and merge off of the PR, now you're talking. Now that's, like, a really good sort of thing. So might save you some headaches down the road. So I think somebody was, I read something, and it was like, look at your, like, if you type git log, you know, like, try to make it read like a book or something like that, or like a chronology. Just in, like, can you at least understand what happened?
I like that. So, here's where it broke down for me recently. Because, for example, if I'm working on some CodePen bug fix or something, 100%. Good commit messages, tiny little bits, very understandable everything, fix this on this, that type of stuff. That'll work great. When I was redesigning CSS tricks, and I've been poking around at the Shop Talk show site, as you did too, I should show it to you. It's like almost ready, I think. I did the thing. I did your little feature requests. The way I work anyway is that I'm just like, I just open the site and I'm just generally polishing things. I'm working on a big redesign. So I might be like, oh, this card needs a little, I'm going to do this. I'm going to move these. And I probably touched 8 files, but there's not a lot of like coherence to what I just did. There's not like, I didn't just do one thing. I did like 8 little mini things because I'm just all over the place. Just wow, polishing. So the commit message makes no sense. And I'm not going to split it into 8 commits to say change border radius to 4 from 6 on this card. I'll spend my whole day writing one-off commit messages. I just be like, did a little polish. Here's 16 files I changed. Done. Because nobody, in this case, nobody cares. You might never even pull this site locally. I have no idea. Maybe you will. But it's like, it just broke down to me. I just like, when I'm doing big redesign work, I just don't care about little micro commit messages.
No. It's definitely who's on your team. How do you care? Usually it's the strongest voice wins. You know, strongest opinion wins, but it does help sort of like, you know, we're just going to write this down once and we all kind of vibe in it. You know, if you have tooling that helps too, that's kind of cool. That tool I think you're talking about was Commitlint. But I just, there'll be a link in the show.
Was I right? Is it a pre-commit hook or is it use some other technology?
You can make it into a pre-commit hook. It's basically just a linter.
Okay.
So you can send any text to it, but then it's like, oh, okay. What are your, but then you can hook it up into your pre-commits, you know. But anyway, and then there's another couple side projects. But then somebody set this how to write a git commit message from Chris Beams. And I thought I got a lot from this. I kind of want the whole git compendium, like how to do GitHub, you know, like, and I may write this just to be like, here's my line in the sand or something. I don't really care, but like, here's how I'm approaching it. Like from A to Z, from local to in production.
I see what you mean. Cause there is a lot of little aspects to it. It's not just commit naming, it's branch naming, issue naming, PR naming, and not just naming, but what's in those things. And yeah.
There's a lot. Like, what are your labels? How do you approach labeling? Cause that could be a whole thing too, you know? And
I just put won't fix on everything.
Won't fix. won't fix. Well, and some people do the, like, we close all issues. This is the Lodash approach. You close all issues and then you open them if they become active. So like, so your whole backlog is just basically closed down issues. But if something comes up and you start working on it, you open the issue. So dangerously controversial.
Never heard of that whackiness.
Well, yeah,
that's kind of cool.
But then like there's strategy. I think, you know, Rich Smith tweeted or wrote about this today, even just was like, you know, like we used to do everything in GitHub issues, but now we started, some stuff happens in Notion, having real clear boundaries on
where discussions happen, huge,
where support happens, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I do my open source. It's like, hey, if this is I can give you a one-liner, try to help you, point you in the right direction, but all help goes to Stack Overflow, and I'm not on Stack Overflow, but like, that's where that, if you want help, that's the website for it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I get it's even, yeah. The public versus not public repos changes a lot in this too. You might want to have literally two different sets of rules depending on how you, if it's a public repo or not.
No. Yeah. Cause discussions is such a huge feature that I don't really have.
I think that's neat too. Projects, yeah. That's been a plague for me for years, is the like, cause I'm the locust in this situation. I'll be like, you know, it would be cool. We should have this in the admin screen, this button. It would be way better if we had this button. And then I'll open it as a bug. I'm terrible. Oops. Because at least we'll look at it. It doesn't feel like it's lost. If I just write it in some Notion doc, that's fine. It's not Notion's fault. It's how you treat it and think about it. But we don't have a place that's like, make sure these things don't fall off the radar. Whereas a bug ticket will not fall off the radar. It's still sitting there. So that was the thing. And you need a better solution for that. I think I don't know that we have all the solutions, but one of them is that you do not do that. You need to draw that line in the sand. Issues are issues, literal bugs. That's how, not for everybody in the world, for us.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And we're damn near zero. That's what I was going to say. I think it's really cool. Good. If you're running your ship at zero tickets, we're not yet, but we're really getting there. It becomes a different ball game. It becomes, if you open a ticket, then you take it really seriously. You're like, this is broken and this is a priority to get it fixed. This is not some hive of crap to just forget about or whatever. Do this on the third Thursday of every month.
No, I think if you can do that, you know, we have a big mix at Paravel, but we actually started a whole other GitHub, a ghost repo, no code in it, but it's just for business. You know, it's like, because we're doing a little whatever project startup-y thing.
Somebody needs to call the state of Michigan to make sure our tax records there are.
Exactly. Who have we talked to so-and-so, such-and-such about whatever Delaware corporation, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, you know, that sort of stuff is like, you need a paper trail. You need like some sort of idea of what's going on. So anyway, yeah.
Well, thanks. That was cathartic to yell about GitHub structure for a moment. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. We should probably call it there. I think we're hitting the time zone. I would love, but we'll be back next week. More conversation and web conversation. So thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star her favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter, Shop Talk Show, 10 tweets a month. And thank you for downloading this. This is really means a lot that you celebrate 2021 and all the calamities with us. We really appreciate it. Hey, Chris, you got anything
else? Send us more convoluted workflows again. That was fun.
Please.
Okay. See you later. ShopTalkShow.com.